This Week in Retronauts, Adam, I hardly even know him. Hi, everyone. Welcome to another episode of Retronauts, starring cool people like me, Jeremy Parrish, and also other cool people. Let's go counterclockwise and then distant.
Hi, I'm Jared Petty, and I love ColecoVision and, strangely, the Coleco Adam.
Hey, it's number three leather salesman in West Hartford, Bob Mackey.
And finally, laughing over the phone.
Hi, it's Nadia Oxford from US Gamer and actually the Blood God podcast.
All right, and we are here to talk about ColecoVision, and you may be saying to yourself, because you are a wise, regular Retronauts listener, but Jeremy Parrish, you guys covered ColecoVision about 5 years ago, 5 or 6 years ago, back when the relaunch of Retronauts was a young whelp of a podcast. And that is true. We did. But I feel like that's a topic that we didn't quite do justice to, and it's no offense to anyone who was participating in the podcast. I just feel like we've gotten better at this thing since then, and we can do a better job of tackling the topic. And so I wanted to take another swing at it because I do have a lot of fondness for ColecoVision. And so we're applying our modern-day, mature, evolved podcasting skills and sensibilities to this topic. And to that end, I have brought in some ringers, people who love ColecoVision. Bob, were you about to say something?
I was going to say, if anyone wants to look up the original, it's Pocket 22, so quite a long time ago.
And it was tiny. Wow. It was a pocket episode.
And I think that was really the problem. No console this physically large could possibly be contained by a pocket
episode. That's true. We tried it with Atari Lynx, and they had to make a smaller version. But they never made a smaller version of ColecoVision because it did not survive long enough to be iterated upon. And that's a shame. But in its brief life, it was home to some interesting games, some good games, and it has a pretty cool story behind it. So we want to explore that. But first, before we do that, I'd like to know how each of you has intersected, how your life has intersected with ColecoVision. Like, what is it to you? How did you play it? What has your experience been? Nadia, tell us, like, why are you calling in from Canada to talk about ColecoVision?
Well, as it turns out, my story is quite Canadian because ColecoVision was my first console. But more than that, my parents just spontaneously brought one home while they were at a hockey game. And,
I thought you were going to say the government gave it to you.
There was a Tim Hortons giveaway and
socialized ColecoVision.
Yeah. But yeah, they just kind of brought one home out of the blue. And I don't know where they got it, probably from some guy in an alley, like, hey, you want to scalp a ColecoVision, but whatever. Yes, it was my first console, and that means Donkey Kong was my first video game, the ColecoVision adaptation of Donkey Kong.
Nice. Bob, how about you?
I may have told this story in the original, but that doesn't exist anymore as far as I'm concerned. But
it's been so long, I don't remember a single word that was uttered aside from ColecoVision.
I've never actually played ColecoVision in my life. I've held the controllers, the really bad controllers, and I've seen it at like cons and things like that. But the ColecoVision was the first time I was actually'd in real life by a nerd.
Nice.
In that I was getting into retro gaming stuff in the 90s, just like reading about all the stuff I missed because this console came out when I was born, 1982. And I read the words ColecoVision, but I wasn't sure how to say it. I didn't ever hear it spoken out loud. No one was talking about ColecoVision in 1999. So I was walking by a guy at a flea market just selling a bunch of old games. And I walked up to the ColecoVision. I was like, oh, ColecoVision. And the guy did go, it's ColecoVision. And then I walked away. So,
and he was right to do so.
It was historic for me to be on ImactualEat in real life. And that happens every day now. So,
wow.
Yeah.
Before Twitter existed, you had to go to a retro gaming show and talk about ColecoVision.
A man. But if you look at Connecticut Leather Company, my pronunciation makes more sense.
Coleco, yeah.
Yeah, Coleco.
I agree.
Coleco. It's for babies who are fussy. Jared, how about you?
And horse.
When I was 3 years old, my parents, like many, purchased an Atari VCS, which was a wise and thoughtful purchase. When I was five, my parents decided that I was going to live at the cutting edge of the computer revolution, and they were going to go purchase me a home computer. And for reasons beyond fathoming, instead of going out and grabbing a Commodore 64 or an Apple IIe, they decided that the ColecoVision represented the wave of the future. Because it came with a printer and a scholarship so I could go to college and a Cabbage Patch doll. And so they purchased that, and the ColecoVision became my household's default home computer for many, many years following, and my parents' chief argument that I did not deserve an NES, which has turned me into an angry and bitter man.
Mm. You seem very bitter when I encounter you. You just seethe.
Yeah, it's all that. It's repressed NES rage.
Right. All right. So I'm remind me what the scholarship was, because it's ringing a bell, but I've forgotten exactly what that was.
That's a joke.
Oh, no, it's not a joke. It's quite real.
Wasn't that a Cabbage Patch scholarship, though? Was it tied to Coleco?
There are two different parts to this. Whoa. So first, there's a tie-in offer where if you purchased a Coleco Vision and Burger Time, you got a free Cabbage Patch doll thrown in. And that was at a period of time where Coleco, they didn't make enough Cabbage Patch dolls to deal with when it took off.
Mm-hmm.
Then they over-manufactured, which ultimately helped destroy their company.
Mm-hmm.
And when they couldn't get rid of their over-manufactured Cabbage Patch dolls, they began to pack them in with ColecoVisions to help incentivize families to purchase
them.
Yeah, there's a pretty hilarious commercial about this on YouTube you can watch. The scholarship was buy a Coleco Atom for roughly $500 at that point, and get a $500 scholarship for your child to go to college someday.
Hmm.
When I went after college to help pay for my wedding, I found my $500 Coleco scholarship still in my family's lockbox.
I thought you were going to say that if you buy ColecoVision and Burger Time, you get an internship at McDonald's or something like that at Hamburger University.
No, as far as I know, the scholarship was specifically an Atom tie-in.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah.
That's like the people who kept their Ninja Turtles 2 Pizza Hut coupon. You should try to reimburse that or whatever at your bursar's office wherever you went to school. Just like, this is coming to me.
Yeah, you owe me, you guys.
Bill, Connecticut.
All right. And as for myself, kind of like Nadia, my parents just brought home a ColecoVision at some point. But this was – I know I talked about this on the previous episode. But this was after the video game crash, probably 1984, early 85 maybe. So they were able to get the ColecoVision and the expansion module version of Coleco Atom for probably a song. I bet it was super cheap. I think, you know, the real cost of that system was just how much space – the boxes took up in our attic. Like, that box was like, you could put the G.I. Joe USS flag in that goddamn thing.
Wow.
It was mad. Like, children could hide in it. You could smuggle, like, I don't know, so many drugs across the border in that Coleco Atom box.
It truly was just a magnificent sarcophagus of consumerism.
It was huge. And the system itself was also huge, because the expansion version used the ColecoVision as the base of the computer, but then it added a keyboard, it added like a processor unit, it added a disk drive, and it added a printer. So it was basically like an entire double-decker desk with, you know, then there was a tiny TV attached to it. It was massive, but you know,
that
it was
so weird.
It was a computer that we could use at home and for a few years.
I just had like the Atari module that you attached to the Coleco.
Yeah, yeah.
But no computers.
Yeah, I had the Coleco version of the Tower of Power with this thing. Mm-hmm. I had the Atom, which was actually – I had the dedicated Atom, not the add-on. And that the ColecoVision itself is immense.
Mm-hmm.
Then the Atom is significantly bigger.
Yeah, the ColecoVision is huge because it has a storage bay for two controllers that are the size of a 1980s telephone handset.
Yeah.
So that has to fit in there in addition to the processor and the GPU and everything.
And the printer itself, this huge daisy wheel thing, is many times the size of contemporary home computers. I mean, it's just a giant super brick, far bigger than like the dot matrix you may be imagining. And then like Nadia, I had the Atari plug-in on the side. And so you did just have this thing. The desk that it took to hold it was – which it was larger than the computer desk. We had to buy a separate section and add it to the side just to hold it all.
It was a monstrosity. But maybe that is to be expected from a company that was not really originally geared toward technology and computers. Coleco was, as Bob mentioned, Connecticut Leather Company when it started out in the, I want to say, 1920s or so. And for a long time, they, you know, worked in leather and stuff. And in the 60s, maybe 70s, a guy named Arnold Greenberg came in as president of the company, and he pushed them more toward technology. And thanks to Greenberg, the company actually got into video gaming pretty early compared to a lot of other companies. They launched their very first video game in 1976, a year after Home Pong was released by Atari. And as you might expect, their initial system was in fact an Atari Pong clone, because everyone was doing that. But in 1976, Pong was very new on the home market, and everyone was trying to get in on it. And Coleco had actually gotten there kind of early compared to everyone else. And Pong chips, the ICs that were used, integrated circuits that were used for Pong home Pong systems, were very constrained by manufacturing limitations. And so lots of people lined up to get allocations of Pong chips to make their Pong clones. But very few companies actually managed to do that. And Coleco was one of the very first because they had kind of gotten their foot in the door early and signed up early. You know, they had priority there. So that really gave the company a boost. And they launched a line called the Telstar. And that was actually the very first game system that my family owned because my father, again, just randomly brought home a Coleco Telstar Alpha someday. And I know it was something that someone had left behind either at the school that he worked at as a teacher or else it was left behind in the men's dormitory that my grandparents supervised. I don't know exactly where it came from. It was just someone's discard. But it was a video game system that we had. It might have been cursed, but I didn't notice. It was a video game system that I could play at home on our family's black and white TV. And I could play table tennis, Hi-Li, Mahjong, which was not Mahjong, the tile game. I can't remember what else, but like handball. Anyway, it had four games and it was black and white only. And it was a video game system that I could play as a kid, and I played it a lot, and that was very cool. And so that was my first encounter with Coleco. But the ColecoVision came many years later, like 6 or 7 years later.
I do speculate, though, that the Telstar story you told there a second ago about the ICs is important to what ultimately happened with the ColecoVision. I don't have any hard fact to back this up at all except the way things played out, but those were not – created by Coleco. They were licensed by Coleco. They were acquired. And I think they learned an important lesson there because they went on to try to make some custom hardware. When they went back to finally making their own cartridge-based dedicated home system, the ColecoVision, they decided to go with off-the-shelf parts. They didn't design outside the industrial design for the controllers and the frame. They're like, you know what? There's already stuff out here we can just plug into something and go and make our own. And that's a very interesting approach that they took over a lot of this period to developing their hardware.
Yeah, we'll talk about that in a bit. I'm curious if anyone here besides me ever played any of the Telstar systems. Some of them got pretty advanced. The most complex one was the Telstar Arcade, which was not your typical game console. It was a triangle, and it had three different sets of controls, one on each side. There was like joysticks or I guess paddles. Then it had – the other side had a gun holster, so it had a light gun. And then the third side had a steering wheel that you could use for a racing game. And it actually accepted cartridges, which I think were like the Fairchild Channel F – maybe the Odyssey 2 where they were jumpers as opposed to actual game cartridges and they just changed the configuration of the system.
I don't know if they were ROM-based or not. I think I've heard they are, but I should have checked before the show.
This was 77, so it's right around the time the Channel F launched, and that was like ROM cartridges were the Fairchild's big innovation. So it's probably the jumpers. Still a spec.
The triangular cartridges, this pyramid-shaped like wonderment. It's like some MAME developer's dream come true. It looks like something you could create to play every arcade game possible in your home. And it's also this glorious kind of wood grain aesthetic. And the revolver looks like a cowboy gun, and it's amazing.
I think I've seen the gun, and it is actually like kind of a terrible thing to say in this day and age given the environment we live in. But it was incredibly realistic and really cool in that regard.
Yes, that was back before people, would be shot to death for just walking out in public. So it was okay to have realistic-looking guns. By the time the NES came out, Nintendo was like, hey, the realistic-looking gun we made in Japan, we can't do that in America. We got to go with crazy space laser. And that's what they did.
Even the gray one was too real.
Yep. They had to make it neon orange.
I remember when I saw a gray one. I had no idea what I was looking at. I was familiar with the orange.
I was like, wow, did this get sun bleached or something? What happened?
Somewhere there's a string universe-like version of this reality where Captain N just carries around a .357 Magnum.
I'd respect him then.
Everyone runs
make
screaming
my day,
when
pal.
He
So the Telstar was not the only game system that were not the only game systems that Coleco created. They also made handheld LED systems akin to the Milton Bradley, Mattel sports games and things like that. But their real contribution to child lust video game history were the mini arcades that they produced in 1982 and 83. And those were like fetish objects. They were kind of expensive. They were like $60, which is not cheap at the time. You had a couple. Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
I don't know. They weren't
What's
mine.
It like
Someone's
in Oxford Mansion there? Jeez.
Were they acquired with hockey games?
Garage.
I remember seeing I've seen these like at flea markets, but I remember seeing them in like movies of the time, like Gremlins.
Yes.
Yeah, so these were kind of akin in technology terms to Nintendo's Game & Watch. But instead of using silkscreened drawings on like a, you know, handheld calculator type thing, these were instead they used vacuum fluorescent displays like you see on microwave ovens, VCRs, that sort of thing, the displays, like the glowing blue displays of the early 80s. They had multicolored VFD displays kind of arranged in like, you know, it wasn't pixelated, but it was like bars where you could, you know, just like on a microwave clock where you have like a single number is represented by this kind of grid of shapes going in every direction so you can create every numeral.
Right.
So that's how these worked. But they were kind of custom built to display very specific games, and they licensed the best arcade games of the time. They had Galaxian, Pac-Man, Ms. Pac-Man, Donkey Kong, Donkey Kong Jr., Zaxxon, and Frogger. Those were like the heavy hitters of the arcade circa 1982. They went all in on this thing, and each of these systems was like a tiny miniature arcade replica. Instead of being a tall machine, you know, like an arcade, it was basically like they cut the coin catcher area of the arcade machine off, so you just had the top half. Mm-hmm. But they were about, I don't know, like a foot tall. Maybe I'm getting the proportions wrong because I was a child and it seemed bigger to me. But they were little mini cabinets that sat on a desktop. And they had a tiny little clicky joystick and pretty faithfully and accurately represented, you know, the video games in question within the limitations of a VFD kind of Game & Watch style display. They were the Cadillac of portable, handheld, you know, not full-size console arcade games at the time.
Have these ever been emulated? It'd be interesting to go back and see like how they recreated those experiences with lesser technology.
Yeah, people have definitely emulated them and tried to get that like the VFD glow and everything. But there was something really special about these machines at the time where it was just like they were so upscale compared to like a Game & Watch or something.
They were boutiques objects.
I think they took up like 4D batteries or something ridiculous.
Oh, yeah. I don't think they had AC adapters either. So it was basically just like pay $1 million and, you know, run the system for an hour.
You're now a Duracell shareholder.
Yeah, pretty much.
Yeah, I believe friend of the show, Chris Kohler's family, drilled a hole in the back of theirs and rigged an AC adapter to it.
That sounds like the kind of thing that his family would do, yes.
But these were boutique objects. The bright screen was lovely. What I think really made them work, in addition to the wonderful industrial design of the cabinet, because the cabinets were so colorful and wonderful.
But also they had the arcade colors. So like Donkey Kong was that kind of sky blue. Pac-Man was bright yellow. Like it was very accurate, very faithful, like very much like the spirit of the thing was there.
And the controls were big enough to use while not blocking the screen. And that was important. A lot of arcade recreations to this day, the controls are not spaced correctly so that you can see the screen and move and really control what's happening at the same time. These were eminently playable, especially Galaxian and Frogger, I think, are a lot of fun. You could play those and enjoy yourself to this day.
Yeah, I feel like the spirit of these really lives on in Numbskull's Quarter Arcade line, and there's two of those so far, Pac-Man and Galaga. And I have bought both of them because they're gorgeous, like replicas of the arcade games, but they're also very playable despite having like very small scale controls. Like everything is very to scale and very accurate, but very well made. And I feel like that is kind of, you know, owning those is me grasping at the thing that I could never have as a child. And actually, like the price of those is right in line, you know, in terms of inflation with what Coleco was charging at the time. So, you know, I'm happy that I can recapture this. In fact, like the same games, Pac-Man, not Galaxian, but Galaga, like it's very much kind of recapturing that. So yeah, like those definitely made an impact on me, had an impact on me, made an impression. And so it's nice to be able to kind of touch on that in sort of like a modern recreation.
This makes me think, Coleco must have had a really capable industrial design department. The Telstar Pyramid, really unique. Nothing looks like it. It's eye-catching. These unique. And the ColecoVision is kind of the first big black console. And so they really did have an interesting eye for trying new things that stood out in a room without being gaudy or ostentatious.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it makes sense to me that if you take a company that started out as kind of craftsmen working with leather and tooling and that sort of thing, like that would translate pretty well into good industrial design. So
what
it makes sense.
Jump, like, though, from like leather to electronics.
Right. Yeah, I agree. Although they did kind of capture, like, stick true to that arts and crafts, you know, textile tradition with their Cabbage Patch line.
Oh, of course. I had one of those, too. My brother threw it in a tree.
Of course he did.
I had a Cabbage Patch that came with my Coleco Adam.
Oh, really?
What was your kid's name?
Kim.
Kim?
He was a boy named Kim. My mom's name was Kim. His birth certificate said Kim, and I didn't know the boys were named Kim, and that was how I learned. My mother said, yes, anyone can have any name they want, and that taught me a lot about life.
That's great. What about you, Nadia?
mine was named, like, Millicent or something like that.
that's so, like, you know, Connecticut.
It is.
It's very New England.
Like, what kind of a name is Millicent? I'd never heard the name Millicent in my life.
It's definitely, like, a New England kind of, you know, a bit posh.
I think I got one in maybe 89 after the craze was over, and it was too close to the movie Child's Play, so I was kind of afraid of it. that's my story.
It doesn't come out.
They're one of a kind. They're Cabbage Patch Kids.
It had the voice of Brad Dourif doing a Jack Nicholson impression.
In a cabbage patch garden all in a row, magic cabbages live and grow. With bunny beak crystals and love and joy, they turn into a Cabbage Patch girl and boy. Cabbage Patch Kids,
growing in the garden.
Cabbage Patch Kids,
growing in the sun.
And the most amazing thing about a Cabbage Patch Kid is that each one grows to be a special one.
All right, so that's sort of the preamble, I guess, to the ColecoVision. But now let's talk about the ColecoVision. 1982 to 1985, gone too soon, RIP, pour one out for our buddy CV. So interestingly, the ColecoVision, which launched in 1982, was basically the same hardware as Sega's SG-1000 and SC-2000 and the MSX standard. All of those launched in 1983, a year after ColecoVision. But Sega actually showed off the SG-1000, like a prototype version of it, in 1981. So is this all like a coincidence that everyone kind of gravitated toward the same hardware spec, or was there like not industrial theft or spying going on, but just like people saying, oh, check that thing out. That's great. Let's do that.
I think it has to do with the two key components in the ColecoVision, the Z80 processor or Z80 and the
Z80.
TI graphics adapter. The Z80 is from 1976. The TI adapters first form came out in 79. So these were established, affordable technologies that were available off the shelf. And I think that's why so many groups gravitated toward throwing a console together around those two, was that they were reliable, affordable, worked well together, and programmers already knew how to deal with both. Mm-hmm. I think that's why around 81 you saw so much demo work there. That's my guess.
Yeah, I can't account for how Sega fits into that, but it does make sense for the MSX, which was designed to be a sort of not open standard. Maybe it was an open standard. It was a standard. It was co-developed by ASCII Corporation of Japan and Microsoft. And the MSX computer line could be like the 3DO, you know, a decade later, could be manufactured by pretty much anyone. And it was, you know, cross-compatible. You could plug an MSX cartridge into an MSX system from anyone, any manufacturer, and it would run. The SG-1000 and the ColecoVision weren't designed to be open like that. But, you know, it kind of makes sense that, as you say, like the sort of open standard of the era was based on this kind of reference platform.
Mm-hmm. And they were so close that we'll get there. Life found a way.
I see. So was there a Jurassic Park game on ColecoVision? I don't remember that one.
No, I didn't play that one.
Okay.
Unfortunately. I wish there had been.
Maybe James Bond. It's the closest I came to movie games. Mm-hmm. I did have Rocky, though.
There was also – wasn't there like a MASH game?
There was an Atari MASH game.
Oh, Dukes of Hazzard. That's what it was. Yeah.
Yeah. I have played the Rocky game. I played a lot of that also, Nadia.
It was a good game. I remember having the soundtrack and everything.
Yeah, so it was kind of like, you know, the approach Coleco took to building their system was kind of like what Xbox did or Microsoft did, you know, 20 years later with the Xbox, just saying like, let's pretty much put together a PC and make it a dedicated games player. But that also allowed them to, just like Sega with the SG-1000, create a computer version of it in the form of the Atom. And that was kind of the downfall of the platform in a lot of ways. But the idea was sound and good. And when they first announced it, everyone was like, oh, yeah, we're going to do that too. Like there was this sudden announcement, like this wave of announcements of Atom-style computers from console makers. And I don't think any of those actually came to fruition because Atom turned out to be a disaster. Video games in America turned out to be a disaster for a while. But, you know, Coleco actually got there.
I do love that historical curiosity that if you decide to build your home console out of off-the-shelf parts, you put it in a huge black box.
And yeah. Second year
was so the paradigm was established.
The bigger it is, the more worthwhile it is apparently.
Yeah, I mean it kind of runs the upholds the tradition of American consoles being way the hell too large and taking up way the hell too much space. You know, I just used an Atari Jaguar for the first time today, and I was actually surprised by how small it is. I was like, what the hell kind of American console is this? This is compact. This is the size of like a Super NES. This isn't
right. It should be the size of a Humvee.
But the controller's there to make up for it.
That's true. That controller, man, you could go surfing on that thing. But the controller on the ColecoVision was no great shakes either.
Oh, boy.
I think there's some debate. I saw this even happening in response to call for community letters on this episode on Twitter, people talking about how, like, is the ColecoVision controller worse or the Atari 5200 controller worse or the Intellivision controller worse? Like, all these systems that launched around this time all had really bad controllers. And I feel like ColecoVision and Intellivision are kind of cut from the same cloth, the same horrible, gigantic bolt of cloth.
I think – I don't know if they ever interviewed the industrial designers behind the controllers, but I feel like they might have been thinking, what device do people feel most comfortable using? The phone. And they went from there, where I think the Wii went, the TV remote. People like the TV remote.
25 years later, TV remotes were a thing. Back in 1982. Two, I think TV remotes were like
you had the clicker.
Very small. They were you had a clicker, or they often were wired into the system still. Mm-hmm. Like they weren't necessarily remote. So
yeah.
I mean the ColecoVision controller even has a telephone style cord. It's like a coiled cord. So it kind of contracts when you put it into the base, which is actually kind of a good idea, but it does like show kind of where their brains were at.
I have strong feelings on those three comparisons. The 5200 controller is garbage.
It's almost good, but it doesn't recenter. It's an analog controller that does not recenter. Try to play Pac-Man on that, and you're like, wow, this is almost a better version than the 2600 version, except I hate playing it.
Yeah, I agree. And you can do the rubber band thing, but they also break constantly. It's almost impossible to find one that works. The pause button's cool. The Intellivision controller was good for Intellivision games, which were slower paced, generally speaking, because of the way that system was structured. And for most of them, it works. But the ColecoVision is first and foremost an arcade port system. And so while its controller is definitely inferior to the Atari 2600 for playing arcade games, it's still better than Intellivision because it's not as mushy and precise, and it's definitely better than the 5200 because it self-centers.
Yeah, so the Intellivision controller was very similar to this one, except the ColecoVision controller has like a joystick knob on it, kind of like a mushroom, a very flat mushroom. Like imagine, you know, World 3-3 of Super Mario Brothers, where you're jumping across the mushroom platforms. Like that inside in profile, kind of shrink it down and stick it on top of a telephone, and you've basically got the ColecoVision controller. Intellivision was
not a give either. It's pretty solid. Like it, I remember when I was a kid, I had to like you were supposed to take it like in between your thumb and finger. But there was no way you were doing that as a kid. I had to like kind of mash it with the heel of my palm to get Mario to go anywhere.
Yeah. You really got a workout playing ColecoVision. But Intellivision had a disc, like this flat disc embedded into the system. And it was terrible for action games. At Portland Retro Gaming Expo last month, I saw an amazing piece of homebrew software. Someone transplanted Castlevania for NES onto Intellivision and did an amazing job of it. Like within the limitations of that system, holy cow, amazing. But playing that game with the Intellivision disc is just miserable. It's such a work of love and passion just derailed by the system. So ColecoVision has that over it, but it is a big controller, and the buttons on it are like, so it has, you know, like a telephone dial button where you press like 2 for game option 3. It's like para español, nuevo 6. You know, it's like, yeah, that's exactly what it's like. But then the action buttons are on either side of the joystick, and they're the, like these spongy things with these hard plastic ridges on them. You have to press really hard, and when you do that, the ridges cut into your finger. Mm-hmm. So you would develop on your thumb and your middle finger. That's how I controlled the ColecoVision buttons. Mm-hmm. You would develop these amazing calluses. You could like crack a rock with your thumb calluses after playing ColecoVision.
Yeah, it was Nintendo Thumb before Nintendo Thumb. I had the same thing happen to me. And holding that little knob hurt your hand after a while. It did have the benefit of the two independent fire buttons. That was nice. That was a time when we really needed that. But they were not great buttons.
Yeah, I mean, you had to get so much leverage on the buttons to make them activate because of the spongy action on them. You kind of – like I always associate playing ColecoVision with pressing both buttons at once just to like squeeze the controller like a vise, and one of those buttons is going to register. So that was definitely a big weakness. But everyone was trying to figure out controllers back then, and it wasn't until next year, the following year, when Nintendo and Sega came out with the Famicom and the SG-1000 that were like gamepad style, that everyone was like, oh, right. And even Sega took a little while to figure it out because they had like a tiny control stick on their gamepad, and Nintendo was just like, no, just a cross pad, and it was so much better. But we weren't there yet. Still, it was a good system for the time, and it actually does have a kind of a connection to Nintendo, thanks to Donkey Kong. Does someone want to explain the drama surrounding Donkey Kong and ColecoVision? Because it was the pack-in game. It was a very important get. It was the best version of Donkey Kong that had ever been seen on a home system to that point, and it made a huge mess.
I forget the drama. What everyone was trying to race to get Donkey Kong as their... like exclusive, right?
Well, yeah. So basically what happened was there was separate licensing for home consoles and home computers. Coleco, like they grabbed the cartridge rights, they had it, and then they also showed off the Atom version, and Nintendo was like, hey, what the hell? Atom is a home computer and you don't have the rights there. And so there was a big to-do, and they had to basically make kind of like this handshake agreement with Nintendo, and kind of fell on their sword. Eventually, Donkey Kong did come out for Atom, and it was the best version of Donkey Kong for a home system. Technically, Nintendo's was more faithful in terms of graphics and layout, but the Atom version had all four stages, and it was very close aesthetically, except it was missing one layer of girders, so Donkey Kong is on the wrong side. Mm-hmm. But it played right, it looked pretty close to the arcade game, and it had the cement factory on Atom, only on Atom.
The Atom and Atari 800 versions, I think, are the only two I can think
of. But the Atari 800 version did not look as good.
No, the Atom one looks – Atom was remarkably capable in the right hand. So that's what drives me crazy about the darn thing. For reasons that will become apparent soon, it was a terrible computer to own. But for a brief period of time, you're like, wow, this really could have worked out well.
Yeah, so if you look at the lineup of launch or launch period, launch window games from 1982 for ColecoVision, you can really see that they were going hard on the arcade conversions, because you had obviously Donkey Kong as the pack-in. Like that was a shot across the bow for every other console maker. Mm-hmm. Like not only do we have the best version of Donkey Kong, it's free with our console.
Where
just
were we in the history of pack-ins? Has this been a
every system
before,
like a lot of systems had pack-ins. I think it was pretty much common standard. Like, you know, Atari 2600 came with Combat. Mm-hmm. I don't remember what came with a Television or 5200, but they all had pack-ins. It was just a given that you were going to have a video game.
5200 was Breakout, which was kind of terrible. But you had this incredible pack-in, the game everyone wanted to play on a home system.
Donkey Kong was only a year old at this point.
Yeah.
So it was still piping hot.
But you also have this kind of, honestly, for the time, a murderer's row of arcade ports all coming out at once. And that's something we haven't touched on much of that is super important. This is another one of those beautiful time capsules where, you know, you look at the 2600 and go, okay, this was obviously made to play this kind of game and the system limitations were stretched. And so you started with stuff like Pong or Combat, and you ended up with Adventure and some other innovations. Coleco was designed to play arcade games at home. And within the limitations of a single screen game, it was stunningly capable.
Yeah, Nintendo. ColecoVision is grouped as one of the quote unquote Generation 2 consoles by whoever the hell came up with these codifications. But you know, that puts it in the same category as Atari 2600, 5200, and Intellivision. It wiped the floor with all of those systems.
Yeah, it was a real step up.
Like in terms of sound, in terms of graphics, in terms of gameplay depth, it like out of the gates, it was basically exceeding all the other platforms available at the time. Like, if the market had not collapsed immediately after ColecoVision launched, I think it would have been a huge hit. Like, it was everything everyone said they wanted about game systems, except maybe the controller.
Yeah, it had the Z80 in it, which the Atari 2600's version of the 6502 was crippled to save money. The 6502 is just a good processor to the Z80. But Atari had to scale things back to save some cash. This was an unfettered, powerful processor for the time. And that TI chip we keep talking about was capable of rendering a very large number of single-color sprites, but high-resolution single-colored sprites, and layering them if you needed to. So while you didn't get arcade-perfect gameplay, you could have a whole lot of things in different colors moving around the screen at the same time. And that was fabulous.
Yeah. For the record, around the same time, you had a computer launched with the Z80 processor, the ZX Spectrum, which had much more limited color capabilities because it didn't have the TI color processor, graphics processor. In 1989, Nintendo launched a system based around the Z80 called the Game Boy.
Mm-hmm.
So like that's kind of what a beefy processor this was for a console at the time. Yeah. Very impressive. But yeah,
I remember it being like one of the best looking versions, because I had several versions of Donkey Kong growing up, and that was definitely one of the best looking ones on the ColecoVision. Even though I always thought that Donkey Kong looked kind of like mean on the ColecoVision, because he doesn't move, and he's like kind of like got this really eerie white face.
He does look frightening. I've never thought about that.
I mean, he's a gigantic gorilla who's angry. What's not to be afraid of?
But he is just standing still, so he's just sort of staring you down.
Exactly. Yeah, when I like grew up and saw how like kind of fun and animated and goofy he was in the arcade and on the NES, I was surprised. I was like, this is my like the thing that scared me in childhood. He's actually pretty fun.
He's a lovable angry ape. Yeah. So I was gonna, as we were saying earlier, there are a ton of early releases for ColecoVision that are just like hot arcade conversions. You had Carnival, the shooter, where it's kind of like Space Invaders, but instead of things above you moving back and forth and then down, they're just scrolling past. And you have very limited ammunition. And you have to avoid letting ducks fly down and steal your ammunition, because ducks are hungry and eat bullets, apparently.
Yeah, that's how it
horrible,
works.
Horrible, horrible untitled duck game. you had actually Cosmic Avenger. I don't know that well. I wrote down that it's a scramble-like shooter.
Mm-hmm.
So Scramble was kind of the precursor to Gradius that came out in 1981. So pretty much a clone by Universal that was apparently pretty good. There's Ladybug and Mousetrap, two maze chase games in the vein of Pac-Man. Neither as good as Pac-Man, but more complex and fiddly, which people thought was maybe a good idea at the time.
Yeah, Ladybug's really solid in ColecoVision. That's a good version.
Let's see, Venture by Exidy, which I've talked about a lot on VideoWorks. It's kind of like a prototype, like a proto action RPG that sort of influenced the Metroidvania genre. It's a really interesting attempt to take the action RPG, like role playing game, and turn it into an arcade experience with like rooms and treasures and monsters and like, you know, zoom in points of view. It's pretty complex.
Yeah, it's like D&D meets Berserk.
Yes, yes. And, yeah, great example. Yeah, great comparison.
And that that venture port for ColecoVision looks so much – the arcade game is big on, again, large single-colored sprites. Mm-hmm. So it really does look true to the source material in a way that when you're seeing that in 1982, you're just like, how is this possible? But even today, that game is snappy and fun and a really good one to go back to and try.
Yep. And Winky, the hero, is so happy. you just really – you want the best for the guy. He's so – he's just
with
smiling
like
all
that,
the time.
You're either going to become really friendly and happy or you're going to off yourself really early in life.
Yeah, like you drive around in a white van and steal children. So let's see what else. There was Turbo, the racing game from Sega, and – Coleco loved this one so much that they created an entire peripheral for it, which we'll talk about later. There was also Zaxxon, Sega's isometric shooter, which I never actually played the cartridge version, but I did have it on tape cassette, Super Zaxxon.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a hell of a game.
Yeah, it's stunning how well they did with this. The one real limitation of the graphics chip in the ColecoVision that it shares with the MSX and the SG-1000 is that scrolling is difficult. And they pull off a very convincing, for the time, scrolling on this. It's jerky, but it's not nearly as bad as you see on some other games. And I think it's because they kind of game the 3D effect a little bit to make it work.
It's not horizontal scrolling. It's not vertical scrolling. It's diagonal scrolling.
Yeah.
That's a party trick.
Yeah, it's all being done in software.
Mm-hmm. And finally, the one thing that was not an arcade game was Smurf, Rescue in Gargamel's Castle, which I don't know if you guys ever played this.
Yes, I played extensively.
Wow. It's kind of a Pac-Land style game, but before Pac-Land.
It is. It's a very, very early version of what we'd think of as a platformer. The Atari version's garbage. The Coleco version's really interesting. It uses layered sprites to create a multicolored Smurf against an extremely bright background. The music is great. It's moody. When you're outside, it's all happy and doo-doo. And you go in the caves and it's doo-doo-doo. Yeah, and at a time when you're not used to having background music in your home video games. It was a very early example of that. It's not especially difficult, but it's colorful and fun. And as you progress through the levels, things change in interesting enough ways that you don't get completely bored. Also, it's a game where you can die by stepping on grass.
You got to watch out for that grass, carnivorous grass. You mentioned the sprite layering, and that's actually a source of one of the more infamous elements of this game, which is that if you make it to the end and rescue Smurfette from Gargamel and, like, I think go back and then scroll onto the screen again, her dress sprite does not render. So people are like, Smurfette's naked. Wow, if you rescue her, she takes off her clothes. It's not actually what happens. It's a sprite layering glitch.
Getting us ready for Avatar.
But yes, that's right. That's an entire generation became horny for blue ladies because of Smurf on ColecoVision. But yeah, a kind of a big game. Like, Smurfs were really big, you know, on television at the time with the cartoon and everything. And people just love those little blue French guys.
It's way better than a licensed platformer like that has a business being. And also, they don't try to scroll. It's single screen to single screen. If you've ever watched the weird Hudson Super Mario Brothers, it does that thing, but it does it better.
Mm-hmm.
Is it the first licensed platformer ever?
I am always reluctant to say anything was the first.
True. The first well-known.
That or Cabbage Patch is pretty early. Yeah.
Cabbage Patch came later.
Okay. So is that 83?
Like, we just went through the entire 1982 list. So I feel like there might have been some other licensed platformer on 2600 by that point.
Mm-hmm.
But I think licensed games on Atari 2600 tended not to be platformers. They were other things. But anyway, it was definitely cutting edge, pioneering. Like, Coleco went after the big licenses and they got them. You know, you mentioned the Atari 2600 version of that, and that was actually developed by Coleco. Maybe this is a good time to talk about the expansion modules.
Oh, yeah.
Because that's where this came from. So I mentioned the Coleco Atom, the computer add-on. As Jared said, it could be purchased as a standalone computer, but it could also be purchased as an expansion module that would plug into the Coleco core unit and turn it into a computer. So that was expansion module 3. Expansion module 1 was basically the Super Game Boy version of Atari 2600. It was pretty much an Atari 2600 system inside a module that plugged into your ColecoVision, and then you could play Atari 2600 games on your ColecoVision instead of having to have two systems hooked up to your computer, to your television, which was, you know, pretty handy. And I think it sold for less than a 2600 console. In any case, Atari was like, I don't know, guys. That seems kind of bad and infringing. And so they had, you know, court battles. And eventually they settled out of court and came to a gentleman's agreement where Atari would publish games on ColecoVision and Coleco would convert their own games to Atari. And the AtariSoft games on ColecoVision are absolutely some of the best games for the platform. Like Atari really – I think, you know, their engineers were like, holy crap, we can work with good hardware now? Yes, let's really go for it. So what are the games? Centipede, Defender, Joust, Moon Patrol, Galaxian. Like really great games, big arcade hits, done absolute justice on ColecoVision. Coleco's games for Atari 2600, whether because of the not being used to work with the constraints of the 2600 6502 stripped-down variant or because they just didn't care about putting good games on their competition's system, those games are all – have a terrible reputation.
Yeah, they're real bad. Yeah. They are – Nadia, you had this thing too, right, the add-on unit?
Yeah, I did have the add-on unit. In fact, it was like the way I knew Atari before I actually knew it came in that like lovely wood grain self-enclosed system. But yeah, I don't recall having any of Coleco's games, but I do remember just being terribly confused about how Atari and ColecoVision could be on each other's systems when I was a little bit older and I had an idea of how copyright worked, but not enough to really like, of course, this was before the internet, so I couldn't go on Wikipedia and say, hey, what's the deal? So I just lived in mystification for some years.
I had a similar situation of weirdness here where I got my Atom, which did not come with Donkey Kong. That was not a pack-in with it. Something else was that we'll get to in a bit. And I had the add-on unit, and I had the Coleco port of Donkey Kong for the 2600 and had a very hard time convincing my parents to buy me ColecoVision Donkey Kong because I already had Donkey Kong. So what was the point?
Right.
And there was a lot of argument around that, I remember as a child. But the other way around,
but why should we buy you nice shoes? You already have some slippers with holes in them.
Exactly. That was what I was trying to convince them. But their argument is, yes, but that Donkey Kong is $30. The other end of it, though, is you mentioned Centipede for AtariSoft. Oh my! For years, this was the best way to play a home version of Centipede. I played that game till my eyes bled because they optimized it around what ColecoVision could do. It was, in the purest, most wonderful way, a port. They're like, what can this handle? What can it not? And they designed the game around a stick instead of a trackball. And man, what a thoughtful – that's a masterpiece.
So expansion module 2, I kind of touched on earlier. It was a steering wheel with a separate gas pedal attachment mainly used – it's called the turbo controller because that was the game it was designed for. I think it might have worked with other racing games, but like it definitely worked with turbo. So if you really wanted an arcade-style racing experience, you could have a steering wheel and a gas pedal. Holy cow, play turbo. Wow.
It's a good wheel. It feels good. Have you ever used it?
I haven't.
It actually feels pretty good.
And then expansion module 3 was the Atom, the computer. Although originally there was going to be an expansion module 3 that was the super expansion, and it was going to run on mini tape cassettes as opposed to full-size tape cassettes. And this never came out. Like they developed it and talked about it. Oh, Jared, you seem to disagree.
Did it?
Did it? I don't know. You tell me.
Well, if when we get to the end of the show notes, there's a thriving, small but thriving ColecoVision fan community that exists today that, among some other accomplishments, decided to create the Super Expander module and sell it. And it does, in fact, through a fan community, exist today as a 32K plus MSX sound system upgrade for a ColecoVision that you can plug into the port and it converts your ColecoVision into an MSX Games-capable console. Add sound channels, it gives it a lot more RAM, which has allowed them to port almost 80 MSX and SG-1000 games straight to ColecoVision.
Wow.
So it never came out, but it does exist as fan fiction. And
but it's physical
remarkable.
Fan fiction.
Yeah,
physical fan fiction.
You can print out fan fiction and you got it in your hands. I'm just saying like
– I apologize.
No. It's I didn't realize that existed. That's really cool.
Like, they gave it the name Super Expander Module. They just took the name and created
it. Well, yeah.
It
why wouldn't you? Yeah. Yeah, so there were a lot of ambitions around the system, and I would love to have seen where it would have gone if, you know, it had survived and if Adam hadn't been delayed so long and been such a mess. But in any case, when the system was alive and thrived, it was very, very good. So 1983, we saw a lot of other great games. I think you're going to mention this, Jared. 1983, we got Buck Rogers Planet of Zoom, which was based on the arcade game Zoom 909. Except had the Buck Rogers license attached. And actually, we touched on this, Bob, last year at Portland Retro Gaming Expo, that Sega Laserdisc game. I can't remember what it was called. But that was like – they basically took Zoom 909 and then added Laserdisc graphics to
Interesting.
It.
Why Buck Rogers?
There was a TV show on at the time.
And that's like a radio serial or movie serial originally, probably?
Yeah, originally Buck Rogers was probably radio, but there was a TV show – starring, I can't remember who played Buck Rogers.
I forget the dude's name right now too, and I'm ashamed of myself because I watched this pretty religiously.
Yeah, well,
there was a robot called Twinkie. He went
Twiggy, and he carried Doctor.
Not Cornelius. That's Planet of the Apes.
Doctor of a Flash Gordon man.
He was basically one robot that had both C-3PO and R2-D2 in one. Whatever his name was. Just like a little circle that Twiggy wore around his chest, kind of like the Public Enemy guy. Flava Flav. Yeah, but it talked to him. Like the pendant guy was like very kind of stuck up and prim and proper, whereas Twiggy was a tough talking punk little robot. So he was like R2-D2, but he looked like a short C-3PO.
He'd be like bitty bitty bitty. Hello, yep. Buck.
Hey, Buck. Yep. Anyway, so Buck Rogers was a thing that was in the zeitgeist at the time. So they licensed an unrelated game and said, Buck Rogers, here you go.
And the Buck Rogers Planet of Zoom super game, the Coleco Adam pack-in.
Yep.
Wow.
It was very much in the vein of Star Wars Arcade.
Yeah, it was. Yeah. And it was not bad. The day I figured out the second button accelerated was a landmark day in my life. I was like, I didn't know you could go faster.
Now I can play the game.
Yeah, it was great.
Let's see. There was also Defender, Donkey Kong Jr., Frenzy, for those who were really into Venture. Now you could just have the pure shooter version of it. Mm-hmm. Frogger, Centipede by Atari, Mr. Do, Pepper 2. What is Pepper 2?
Pepper 2 is an arcade port to Pepper 2, which is a game that does not have a Pepper 1.
Yeah. Yeah. Right?
Yep.
But what is it?
I've played it and it's –
Is it kind of Burger Time-ish?
It's so – I literally can't remember. I've played this game several times and I cannot remember what happens in it. It's not
Nadia,
very good.
Bail us out here, Nadia.
I have no idea.
All right. Let's see.
I have failed you.
Gorf, Jared, you put a note here?
Oh, just that ColecoVision Gorf is as good as it could be without the Galaxian license. I'm angry because all home versions lack the Galaxian stage. And
well,
therefore,
you also had Galaxian.
So I could just plug that in between stages. There
just swap out the two.
Yeah.
Minor 2049er, which is a platformer – not platformer, but kind of like a – how do you describe that game? I can't remember.
If you're British, you love it.
Yes. Mm-hmm. There you go. Popeye by Nintendo. Pitfall, was that Atari Soft? No, that was Activision.
That was Activision. And that is a curiously – I don't know if this speaks for how much they accomplished with the 2600 version or how little they accomplished with the ColecoVision version, but it's not that different. It really does – it looks a lot like the Atari version. And I guess they just didn't really want to improve on perfection there. So the restraint's kind of refreshing.
All right. There was a port of Time Pilot by Konami, which wasn't that a Yoshiki Okamoto game?
I don't know who developed it.
I think that was one of his very first creations.
I do not know.
Then he went to Capcom.
I played it a lot. I have no knowledge of its history. I know I like this port.
All right. Actually, that might have been Tokoro Fujiwara. I don't know. There were a couple of Konami guys who defected over to Capcom.
No kidding.
And one of them I know worked on Time Pilot.
Do you like Time Pilot?
I always got it mixed up in my head with Sky Kid. But I think I like Sky Kid better.
Oh.
Time Pilot is Okamoto.
Okay.
There we go. Let's see. Qbert. Jared, you wrote Fascinating Port. Tell us. Tell us why it's fascinating.
For a couple of reasons. One, because, again, the restraint. They used the capabilities of the hardware to make the best Qbert they could on Coleco instead of trying to make it exactly like the arcade game. So they managed to pull the cubes off and create the 3D effect with the full 7 fields. It's not truncated like some home Qberts are. But they leave him a single-colored sprite. So he has transparent, vacant eyes, and you can see the stage through them. but it plays
he's a bit of an airhead.
Yeah, but it plays so well that you don't care. And they were smart enough to make it easier. They take out through most of the modes the part where you get that you get to in Cubert where jumping on a cube changes it back to the original color. They're just like, no, we'll just keep adding layers and not get to the part where Cubert stops being fun. And I really appreciated that. I would play this game for sometimes 3 or 4 hours at a stretch as a kid on a single virtual quarter.
Yeah, I remember I had like the Atari version, which was actually not bad, but it did like, it was kind of frustrating, especially with the way the Atari controller was, and ours was particularly loose, so Cubert would go jumping off the side by himself. But I do like the idea of it not changing back. I've never got to play the ColecoVision version.
So looking ahead to 1984, the games industry in the U.S. had crashed, but Coleco kept churning out games for a little while longer. And there's some weird stuff here. I forgot to mention BC earlier, but there was a sequel, BC2 Grog's Revenge. The fact that there were video games based on the BC comic strip, like that is...
Isn't that the Christ comic thing?
Yes. Well, it didn't start out that way. But then at some point, Johnny Hart was like, yeah, Jesus. And so his cavemen started talking about basically Jesus and about, you know, being saved and born again, despite that being a wild anachronism. So, yeah, it's an odd one.
Yeah, I think sometimes Jesus kind of wants to say to Johnny, chill a little bit there, man.
Make the cavemen golf. Yeah. I mean, that's all people want.
As a kid, I really liked BC because I was like 7 years old and was like, that's funny. I like that the clams like to get drunk on grapes. And I still... I still have a BC tiny tumbler that I think was given away at Marathon gas stations in the 70s. And it, like, this was handed down to me. My parents were like, here you go, after my grandparents gave it to them. So like just for irony, that is what I use for when I age a cocktail in a barrel. When I want to do tastings of it, I pour it into the Jesus cup.
But these are kind of – pseudo endless runner platformer games pre-Mario again and interesting for some of the things.
Yeah, because one of the gimmicks of BC, the comic, was that one of the characters invented the wheel. So I think in the games, you're like on the wheel.
Yeah, you're on a unicycle.
It's a unicycle basically. And you're just like kind of Moon Patrol-ish, but yeah. I guess before Moon Patrol even. So kind of an innovative game, like in the Metro Cross Moon Patrol style, but before them. Interesting. Let's see. There was Congo Bongo. Was this the only system to have Congo Bongo and Donkey Kong? Probably not.
No, sure, the Atari 800 had it as well.
I was going to say. Yep. But still, Ikegami Tsuchinki's Donkey Kong ripoff after Nintendo ripped off Donkey Kong from them that went to Sega showed up on ColecoVision, and I still don't understand that game.
Want to make Donkey Kong less playable? Make a Congo Bongo. Want to make Congo Bongo less playable? Take it home.
It's something I like to try whenever I see the cabinet, but I just 30 seconds in, I'm like, what's even happening?
Did you know there are stages after the first one?
I refuse to
believe
that.
And they're totally different. I've seen footage, and it's like, wow, I had no idea.
This year at Calyx, I made my first complete cycle through all the stages of Congo Bongo in my life, and I felt like a god.
Let's see. So Cabbage Patch Kids, there's two of them. I don't care. Dukes of Hazzard, I also don't care.
You don't care, but we should note that the Cabbage Patch game does include children being murdered in horrible ways.
Whoa.
Wow, that sounds like something we're talking
dark.
About.
What is this?
Like, it's a playground.
Is this a Yoko Taro game? What's going on?
It's a playground side scroller where you have this large sprite of a child wandering across playground equipment, but they keep like being eaten by flowers or falling into water. And, you know, they're fine, but they're not fine.
Sounds like some sort of
I guess they were like, man, this industry is dead. We might as well just go for it.
Go for broke.
Yeah, right. Dukes of Hazzard. Did any of you happen to play that game?
Mm-mm. I played it. It's garbage.
Yeah?
Yeah, it's not very good.
Does it make you say the South must not rise again?
I think there's a lot of reasons to say that. Yeah. I can't remember. I don't think they managed to get the digitized hee-haw into that either. So,
did they get the music at least?
It's been – this is one I haven't played since like 86, so I do not remember for sure.
Ah, we're fine without it. Antarctic Adventure by Konami's in there. I did not realize that.
Mm-hmm.
Is that an official release?
I think so.
Okay. Because I know there's a lot of kind of blurred boundaries with the ColecoVision because people port over SG-1000 and MSX games.
Yeah.
So that's big in the homebrew scene. So sometimes you're like, wow, this game was on ColecoVision? No. Someone ported it there 20 years later.
No, I think this is the 84 list of actual things that did come out is my guess. I could be wrong about this because there have been ports. There's a bunch of those, but
yeah,
I
missed out on a lot of the later releases. Antarctic Adventure, Bump and Jump, Gyrus, Hero from Atari 2600. I had no idea. Was that an AtariSoft game?
Activision.
Okay. Montezuma's Revenge.
The fact that Gateway to Opsi exists on this thing breaks my brain a little.
Why does that break your brain?
Because it's an – oh, go ahead. Nadia's going to say something, I think.
Oh, we actually talked a little bit about that. We actually have a Acts of the Blood God episode where we talk about ColecoVision RPGs. And there's – it's not like a whole dedicated episode to ColecoVision RPGs because that would be the shortest episode ever. But yes, we did talk a little bit about – was it – not Temple of Apshai.
Gateway
to Apshai. That was more of a – it was like – first of all, it was quite a complex game for the ColecoVision. Second of all, it was a lot more – like it was a little different from Temple of Apshai, which I had on the computer. It was like more of a side-scroller.
Mm. Okay, Gateways – I didn't know that actually.
Yeah, it was definitely it was a little less RPG-ish and a little more action-y, as I recall.
Like the computer games, did it ship with a manual that had a written text description for every room that you could compare to the number?
Oh gosh, I don't even know, but I would hope so because that was the whole point of like those RPGs back in the day, just having all those big ass manuals.
I cannot believe that because obviously the thing's technically capable, but I can't believe they managed to get this into production before the thing fell apart. This is a game that would take a while to port.
Let's kind of go through this list really quickly. Qbert's Cubes, the weird sequel that's not actually any fun, was on there. Space Panic, Jared, you say it's superior to the arcade. This is an important game because it's the midway point between Hey Yonkyo Alien and Lode Runner.
Exactly. It is very much like Lode Runner. And the arcade game is not fun, in my opinion, the Universal arcade game.
It's really primitive and
Yeah, the Coleco version is smoother, faster. The horizontal aspect ratio of the screen works in its favor. You feel more like you're in control of what's happening. The aliens are slightly less aggressive in the early stages. It's easier to stack them. It feels more like Lode Runner, frankly. It's great. When I played Lode Runner after playing this, I was like, oh, whoa. That's it. And as a kid, I was like, is this a Lode Runner game? I kind of went back. But yeah, it is the way to play Space Panic. It's way better than the arcade game.
Also, Rock and Rope, another game by a Konami to Capcom defector. This one was designed by Tokuro Fujiwara, who would then go on to take the ideas and make Bionic Commando. So God bless this game. War Games, you say it's weird. Jared, why is that?
It's like what if you put Missile Command on the Intellivision?
Can we not?
Yeah, that's good. It's like here's an arcade missile shooter game, but also here's a giant strategy map that uses all the face buttons. It's weird.
And finally, to wrap up the official releases, continuing the Johnny Hart universe, the Wizard of Ids, Wizmath.
Is that Johnny Hart? He does that too?
Yep.
Okay.
Yep. It's same art style, same.
I confuse that with Croc, the other very popular comic, which are probably still running somewhere.
I think Wizard of Id was a collaboration between Johnny Hart and the Beetle Bailey guy.
I did
Mort
not
Walker.
Know that.
Mort Walker, yes. I'm pretty sure.
I'm learning a lot about the Wizard of Id and BC today.
Yeah, I had an aunt who owned a ton of those little paperback collections of both comics when I was a kid. And like I, you know, would go over and whenever I visited, I'd just like sit down with her big stack of Peanuts collections and stuff. And yeah, good times, good memories, but kind of weird that they made video games out of those things. There were a few prototypes that were produced for ColecoVision but never actually manufactured. which includes a conversion of Porky's for Atari 2600, the video game about peeping on girls in showers. I guess Joust never actually made it out. Ms. Pac-Man, Moon Patrol, Dig Dug, and the original Pac-Man also. So interesting.
Yeah, there was never an official release of Pac-Man.
All right, so to wrap up, we should talk about the Coleco Atom. We've touched on it quite a bit, but this was a full computer. It was a computer that you could do. I mean, you've got the smart basic tape cassette over there.
I do. I brought it to bless this meeting. It has it, my friend.
Oh, I was there to see it.
Yeah, it's still sealed here. It is, and let's
very
be clear,
80s looking.
It's a digital data pack.
Mm.
So yeah, this is Atom Basic on a cassette, because the Atom, at a time when everyone was moving to floppy drives, decided to embrace cassette drives and had an eternal one so badly designed that when you turn the unit on, if you left the tape in, it would erase your
yes.
tape.
Mm. There was like an electromagnetic pulse.
Yep.
It was just like being in the Matrix.
It was a special cassette. You had to buy special tapes because it ran it. It was actually, I think, as fast as the Commodore 1541 like floppy drive interface. It was really quick considering, but it was still awful.
Yeah, I mean, compared to people's tales of horror of having a British microcomputer and loading games off of those for 20 minutes at a time, the ColecoVision was like 30 seconds to a minute to load a game like Super Zaxxon. It wasn't that bad.
Yeah, it really wasn't.
I mean, not great, but you know, considering, it was okay. And once a game loaded into RAM, it was pretty much there.
And if the thing hadn't shipped broken, they had so many returns early on, if it had had a chance to survive, I imagine they'd have moved to floppy disk pretty quickly.
There was a disk drive.
Yeah, there was a drive, and I think software would have moved with it if they'd had one more year. Mm-hmm. That's kind of where they went with the C64 too.
So let's see. The Atom added more RAM, more video RAM.
Just more RAM. They used the ColecoVision's RAM as video RAM.
Okay. Got it. I see. So that's kind of what Sega did with the SG-1000, the Master System. The SG-1000 was like the core of the Master System, but then they added a ton of video RAM or something. I can't remember exactly what, but basically they kept iterating on the same hardware design to the point that you got the Sega Genesis using the Master System as like the I/O controller or something, Sony also did the PlayStation 2. Like this kind of iterative design is really interesting, and this was one of the first examples of that.
Yeah. If it had worked, it was a decent computer for the time. The price point was right. It came with a printer at a time when printers were hundreds and hundreds of dollars. And so the fact that you got not just a printer, but a daisy wheel, like a letter quality printer, a typewriter printer. And this is before the print shop, so nobody wanted dot matrix. That was bad then. Everything switched when the print shop came out. Mm-hmm. Suddenly we all wanted dot matrix. Until then, everybody wanted a nice printer. It came with one. It had a good keyboard. One of the top features that I don't hear talked about nearly as much is that it came with a good built-in word processor in the ROM.
Mm-hmm. There was also a typing tutor.
Yeah, there was a typing tutor.
I still remember the music when you would complete a lesson. Like that music is drilled into my brain. It's been 35 years.
Do you hear when you finish an article?
What's that?
Do you hear it when you finish an article?
Yes. Do
your ringtone.
Gosh, I don't think I had the typing tutor.
Okay, well.
I love the song.
It's great. Yeah, it's very upbeat. Makes you really feel like I wrote words good.
Yeah, you had the typing tutor. You had Basic. You had Logo. My dad wrote his doctoral dissertation on the word processor and saved it on those tapes.
Wow, that's very advanced. My dad wrote his doctoral dissertation on a mainframe at the university.
That's so cool.
He would bring home these reams of computer printout paper, and it was pretty wild. Right.
That is rad.
It's free art paper for me to draw on.
What was your dad's degree in?
I don't remember exactly. He's got a doctor of education.
Okay.
So, or doctorate in education. So something education related. Couldn't tell you more.
But Jeremy, you and I were both like cursed with this thing. I mean, growing up, was this your home computer?
It was a blessing. It was fine. it was our home computer for a while, and then we didn't have a home computer, and then we got a Windows 3.1 system, and then I graduated and had a Macintosh, and that's where I've been.
My problem was I got it, and then immediately the software market dried up. And so we were getting these newsletters in the mail with homebrew programs that people were trying to charge $40 for. And you just like mailed off and hoped what you got worked. And it was sort of like living in 1977 computer land in 1986 was where we ended up. But I have a lot of affection for the thing, but the day the Apple II came home was a very special day.
Well, according to you, the Coleco Atom was a more capable computer than the stock Apple II Plus, which is kind of a bold claim because that was a heck of a machine.
It was, but the Atom shipped with more RAM. You had to put the language card in the Apple II Plus to make that work. It had expansion slots and was capable of 80 column output if you did it, same as the Apple II Plus. But mainly I'm giving it the advantage there on the incredible ColecoVision graphics hardware. The Apple II, even later in life, had to rely on software. Mm-hmm. The Apple IIe was certainly a superior machine to the Atom. But the Atom itself, I think, had a little more oomph than the II Plus. I don't know if y'all would agree or not, but I think it was the only thing wrong with it was that it shipped half its first units broken and never got a chance to recover.
Yeah, and it was delayed for a long time too. Like it was supposed to come out much, much sooner than it did. And because of the production delays and the rising cost over the original target price, it didn't launch well. It was too late and it cost too much. If it had come out on time on its original kind of target price point, I think it would have been very successful, but they messed up.
They did. I did write my very first quote-unquote video game on the Coleco Atom in Logo. I customized my sprite on my tape.
You put game in quote marks.
Yeah. Well, it was a moving sprite, and I wrote a title screen song with an animated title screen, which I later realized I stole the song from Activision Star Master, but I didn't realize that for a long time.
They forgive you.
Yeah, and I never pulled off collision detection. So, but that was my first quote unquote game was on that. Besides Typing Tutor, what'd you do with yours, Jeremy?
I mean, we had a graphics program that used the Coleco controller to draw stuff on the screen, and then I would draw these things on the window, and then use the printer to print them out. Now you may say, how can you do that on a Daisy Wheel printer? Well, my friend, it would print out like 6 pages for a single bitmap image and basically do like different letters to denote different degrees of intensity and darkness. So it was like monochrome. It took about 20 minutes for one of those things to print out. My family, I'm sure, hated it because I would draw and then I would print something out and it would just be like for about 20 minutes just filling the house while they were trying to watch TV.
That is the loudest printer I've ever encountered on a home computer.
But they were very tolerant and very patient. They were like, Jeremy's being creative on the computer. That's great. That's what it's for. Let him make the noise. And I don't remember ever getting in trouble for it or, even my siblings being like, shut up. Maybe they were and I've just blocked it out. But
have we mentioned yet
that the – them.
Oh, go ahead, Nadia.
I was saying you probably couldn't hear them.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah. They were angry and I never knew it. That's why I never talked to them anymore.
Mentioned that the power supply for this thing was in the printer yet?
No, I don't remember that.
The power supply for the computer is in the printer.
Okay.
Wow.
If you buy the Atom full, like the full Atom version, or if you have the expansion module, they decided, you know where the PC power supply belongs? The printer.
The peripheral. Why not? Why not the add-on element that's not essential to the running of the machine?
Which meant if you ever wanted to use any other printer, or if your printer broke, you had to replace the entire computer.
Wow.
Good times. So the ColecoVision did not last that long. It had like a 2 to 3 year lifespan, and Coleco struggled, and they were hit really hard by the video game market crash. They were also hit by, the problems that they had with the Coleco Atom, and so they eventually went out of business. I think they soldiered on for a little while with the Cabbage Patch line, which was very successful until it wasn't, and they went bankrupt in like 1988.
What really sunk them, this is not even a joke, was a storytelling Alf doll. They were trying to chase Teddy Ruxpin fever and didn't quite work.
I knew there was something Teddy Ruxpin.
I was going to guess it was the Cabbage Patch doll that ate hair.
That didn't help.
They should have just stuck to above ground pools.
Yeah. And yeah. Like made out of leather. A leather pool. So anyway, despite its brief life, ColecoVision sold, I think, a couple million units total, which was pretty decent for the time. Obviously not a hit on the scale of Atari 2600 or Commodore 64, but reasonable. So it has a decent following. There's a decent kind of underground homebrew scene, as Jared touched on earlier. And like the people who kind of cut their teeth on the ColecoVision homebrew scene are still kind of big players in the industry. I did not realize until I was researching for this episode that Kevin Horton, who goes by the name Kevtris. He's the programmer who's responsible for all the analog systems, the fully programmable gate arrays that – not Gatorades, gate arrays that power those systems, the Analog NT and the Mega SG and Super NT and the upcoming Analog Pocket. Like those are all – like he does the engineering on those. And his very first – or one of his first creations was the world's first ColecoVision homebrew, which was a Tetris clone that he called Kevtris. So he still goes by the handle of the Coleco homebrew game that he made 25 years ago. That's pretty cool.
I had no idea. I'm pretty sure Kevtris is on my hard drive at home right now. I've played it many times. I had no idea he was the analog guy. That's so neat.
He is probably the most respected FPGA developer in the world, and this is where he came from.
If you want to see what it was like, the Cool CV emulator is still out there. And the folks at Team Pixel Boy that I've talked about who make a lot of the MSX ports have released a few of those ROMs for free. They just gave them out. So if you want to try like Thexter on a ColecoVision, go to town. Actually, it's pretty good. That's the shocking bit. I couldn't believe how good a job they did with it. And again, they're emulating the expanded hardware. Cool CV knows how to emulate the super expansion module that the community created. So
it's I'm friends with Pixel Boy. A long time ago, we used to talk all the time on like IRC in like the 1990s.
That's so cool. Can you explain the mania? Because, man.
What's that?
Well, at this point, they've done 74 ports. Can you explain the mania?
Oh, no, just I lost touch with them a long time ago. And so when I was actually researching for the Coleco version of the Blood God, I saw his name. And I'm like, I'm pretty sure that's a guy I used to talk about Mega Man with all the time in the like 1998 on my parents' like 486 of their cheap-ass IRC program.
I cannot wait to listen to this Blood God episode.
You should, absolutely should. It was Kat and I had a good time with it.
Before we wrap up, what about the Coleco Chameleon? I just remembered that.
So Coleco now exists as a holding company that has a name. And Coleco, actually the modern Coleco, which is unrelated to the original Coleco. It's just like...
Sort of like Atari, right?
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah, there was the Coleco Chameleon that was actually going to be built around Atari Jaguar CD, like the case for that. So it was a mess. Let's not talk about it. The guy behind it, I did some writing for him when he ran Retro Game or Retro Magazine. And I think he's a nice guy who has a genuine passion for what he was trying to do, but went about it in very wrong ways and made a mess of things. So it's very unfortunate. Coleco also has sold its name to a line of sort of modern mini arcades. Built around its you know, the mini arcades that it sold back in the early 80s, the VFD machines. But they're like, you know, I think probably running Android emulators with LCD screens. So you can still find Coleco as a name around in the world, but it's not really Coleco. ColecoVision itself, I think there have been some ColecoVision flashback machines sold by AT Games, which is also not good. So I feel like Coleco deserves a better legacy than it has.
Is it worth going back to, Jeremy, because of the fact that, that so many arcade ports on limited hardware, it's a really amazing curio and time capsule. Do you think it's worth people going back and exploring since there are now more arcade-accurate versions of most of these games? Are people going to enjoy going back and experiencing ColecoVision?
Man, it's really hard for me to say. Like, I have not revisited this machine myself. But, you know, putting together this episode made me think, I wish I could. I wish someone would – I guess there is – you know, the option to run FPGA versions of the ColecoVision. I think the Analog NT Mini Jailbreak can do that, and I think also the Mr. FPGA system can support ColecoVision. So that's probably the way to do it. I don't think I would go to the trouble of tracking down the hardware, using that original controller. It's all kind of a mess. But I do think as kind of like this, you know, sort of in-between state – like the midpoint between Atari 2600 and NES, There is some value in exploring it, and there are some unique games that were released for ColecoVision, stuff that I'm interested in checking out, like why the hell was there a Wizard of Id game, and why was it a math game?
People wanted it. They demanded it.
Like, what does math have to do with Wizard of Id? Nothing. That's interesting. It's weird.
He's a math magician.
Oh, there you go. Problem solved.
That's my contribution to this episode.
So that's my thought on revisiting ColecoVision. Probably not worth tracking down the machine, but if you have other ways to experience it, sure, try it out. And again, it does share a lot of DNA with the MSX and the SG-1000, so just kind of roll them up all at once and experience all those things, because they are all kind of this sort of interim period in video game history that doesn't get explored a lot. What about you, Jared?
Yeah, I everything you just said, I think I mirror an opinion. I like time capsules. I like getting a feel for – one of the problems with having almost unlimited hardware power in the modern era is that limitations aren't there to force you to change your games in ways that are sometimes compromises but other times end up improving them. You still see some of that in the ColecoVision, less so than the 2600, but there are still some examples of people pulling off – you think about Turbo and the way that they – overcame the problem of having a horizon come toward you on that hardware and some of the really cool tricks they pulled. It's neat to see. I've had fun going back with Cool CV and playing around. I've owned some Atoms. I don't have one right now. They're harder and harder to get and more expensive. Mm-hmm. And I haven't felt the need to go back. But discovering that Pixel Boy's grown so much and fooling with some of the stuff that's out there available for emulators has made me think, you know, an FPGA solution and playing some of these games because they have such a beautiful, distinct look. An SG-1000 game, a MSX game, and a ColecoVision game, all of this common palette and look and that aesthetic. It's a lot like the PC Engine or the TurboGrafx where nothing quite looks like a Hudson game from that period. The artistic value alone, I think, is worth the investigation.
Nadia, how about yourself? Do you want to go back and re-explore ColecoVision? It kind of sounds like you have.
Yeah, we did a little bit with the Blood God, like I said, but I think I echo a lot of what you did say, because I feel like it is an overlooked part of gaming history. And I feel like the ColecoVision was definitely ahead of its time. And I think if a lot of people looked back on it and realized what time of year this thing was made in, they'd be quite impressed with what they saw. Unfortunately, it all sank alongside the rest of the systems at the time and during the video game crash. But I don't know if I would recommend shelling out a ton of money to play one, but by all means, if you can get your hands on one and explore like at least Donkey Kong and see what they were capable of back then, I would say absolutely go for it.
All right. And Bob, where do you stand on the ColecoVision question?
I'm happy that people have nostalgia for it, but I'm also happy I was born in 1982 and the NES was my first real console. The Atari 2600 was like sort of the hand-me-down that I sort of messed around with as like a very young kid. But like when I was, in the 90s getting into retro games, these were these dusty things in flea markets. You wondered what they were, why they had phone controllers. But it's nice to know that there is like love for it and there was – the market could support it for at least 3 years. So yeah. As for me, I probably would just watch videos of these games just because they are kind of interesting and I've never played these ports. But I would kind of just rather play the arcade originals because I don't have nostalgia for these interpretations.
All right. Well, that I think is all that needs to be said about ColecoVision, although a lot of you have said things about ColecoVision. But actually, I got so many letters about ColecoVision that we do not have time to read them all. So we're going to do a separate mailbag segment at some point and touch on all the comments that you guys have submitted through the website and through email. Because clearly we're not the only ones who have some fond nostalgia for ColecoVision, have some memories of cutting our teeth on that gigantic system with those humongous controllers. So thanks everyone who wrote in. We are not overlooking your contributions. They will just be acknowledged some other time, but thanks. Anyway, that wraps it up for this episode of Retronauts. So we're going to wind down now by telling you about ourselves. I'm Jeremy Parrish, and you can find me on Twitter as GameSpite. And on YouTube as Jeremy Parrish, P-A-R-I-S-H, not two R's. Thank you. And, of course, you can find Retronauts at retronauts.com. You can download it on iTunes and other assorted podcatchers. And, oh, yes, you can support us monthly on Patreon. $3 a month will get you access to all of our podcasts. That's like six or seven a month. a week early with higher sound quality. Yes, that's right. No advertisements. Basically all the niceties that you want from a podcast. So your support helps keep us alive and keeps the show going. So please consider contributing. But if you can't or don't want to, that's okay. You can still listen to the show for free. Nadia, how about you?
Oh, like I said earlier, I am Nadia Oxford with usgamer.net, and I am also the co-host of the Axe of the Blood God podcast, and that's myself and Kat Bailey, the editor-in-chief of the site. We talk about RPGs, new, old, Western, Eastern, and as I did mention earlier, we did have an episode covering RPGs on the ColecoVision, and I think we doubled that up with the Atari 2600. So please give us a listen. We'd appreciate it very much.
Jared?
Yeah, I host the Top 100 Games podcast, which you can find on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify. Just search for Top 100 Games podcast or my name, Jared Petty. That's a show where a succession of guests come on, and starting at 100 and slowly working our way toward one, we rank the 100 greatest games of all time, and we do that by having each different guest pick the game for that spot. So one guest picks game 100, next guest picks 99. It's really just an excuse to be effusive and talk about games we really love, interact with our audience in some fun ways, and take good-natured pot shots at our other friends in the industry. Mm-hmm. So I hope you enjoy that. And I'm Petty, Jared on Twitter.
And Mr. Mackey.
Hey, it's me, Bob. I'm on Twitter as Bob Servo. I also do other podcasts outside Retronauts, and they're about old things that aren't video games mostly. So that's Talking Simpsons and What a Cartoon. That is a chronological exploration of The Simpsons and an episode for What a Cartoon. We do an episode of a different cartoon every week, and you can find those for free on wherever you find podcasts. But we have all kinds of extra bonus things and exclusive miniseries on patreon.com/talkingsimpsons. So check it out. I think you'll like it. Thank you.
And that wraps it up for the ColecoVision episode of Retronauts. Remember to take this cassette out of your computer before rebooting.